I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, Episode 51, The Themes. Last time, we followed the early career of Constance II, the teenage emperor who essentially took over the government of Romania after his grandfather's death. After suffering defeats on every front, the now 26-year-old was very relieved when news came of the death of the Caliph Uthman in Medina. The Augustus didn't know how long the Muslim world would be turned inward, but the retreat of Muawiyah's unbeatable Syrian army allowed him at least a year or two to better organize the Roman military for whatever was to come next. Obviously, the Byzantine army was in poor shape. It had lost every major battle for over 20 years now. The main armies in Anatolia had very low morale and little hope of turning the tide. While in Italy and Africa, the troops had seemed perfectly willing to go along with rebellions against the government in Constantinople. Constance was determined to do something about this and launched himself into action. In 657, he sent his forces back into Armenia. The new prince installed there by Muawiyah was happy to cooperate with the Byzantines now that the Arabs were out of sight. The following year, Constance became the first emperor since Maurice to campaign in the Balkans. Marching out through Thrace, the emperor attacked the Slav tribes that now lived along the coast road to Thessalonica. Heraclius had received some dubious promises of obedience from these settlers, and now his grandson was determined to bring them to heel. The emperor wanted to do more than remind them of the power of the empire, though. He captured thousands of prisoners, put them on transport ships, and settled them on abandoned farmland in Anatolia. You may remember from the history of Rome that during the long battles on the Rhine and Danube frontiers, the imperial authorities would often recruit thousands of barbarians into the Roman army once they were defeated. That same policy would be reenacted by multiple emperors from now on. Anatolia had been subjected to raids and sackings for about 40 years now, first the Persians, now the Arabs. With the plague still popping up now and again as well, the area desperately needed an influx of new settlers, particularly if the Byzantine army was going to find new men to fill the ranks. The Slavs were understandably angry at their treatment, and about 10 years later, a division of 5,000 Slav soldiers will take the opportunity to defect to the Arab side and were resettled in Syria. It's an amazing migration story for men whose grandparents may have grown up well north of the Danube. By 659, Muawiyah was deep in arbitration with his rival for the caliphate, Ali. This Muslim civil war was the one which began the division of the Middle East into Sunni and Shiite believers. The governor of Syria sent word to Constance that he wanted peace, and he was willing to pay for it. The generous terms of the truce meant that the Arabs would pay the Romans about 5,000 pounds of gold a year and give them a slave and a horse for every day that the deal was honored. No one was fooled into thinking that the Arab tribute in any way suggested Roman superiority, but clearly Muawiyah believed that Constance's armies could do significant damage if he didn't neutralize them. The emperor gladly agreed to the terms and pushed forward with his plans to reorganize the army. We now enter very murky territory as we talk about the establishment of the Byzantine themes. I imagine most of you have heard of the themes, but if not, then they were the new military districts which the empire was divided into. Anatolia, for example, was to be split into five themes. Each one would have its own army, who would live inside the theme, man and defend its forts and cities, and protect it from Arab raids. You may have also heard that once the armies were assigned to their district, that they were then given land which would support them. The sons of these soldiers would therefore inherit both the obligation to fight for the empire and the productive land to pay for their upkeep. The added bonus of this system is that these men would now be fighting to protect their own property, thus ensuring their loyalty to Romania. However, that last part may never have been true, and certainly seems highly doubtful for the 7th century. I will doubtless talk about the development of the Roman army at the end of each century, when we can go into all of this in more detail. For now, though, it's important to stress how little we know about the development of the themes. There's a general consensus that during the next 3 years, 659 to 662, while the Muslim civil war continued, Constance began the process of finding permanent bases for the field armies in Anatolia. We don't know if this was the emperor's idea, or the work of an advisor, or if it came from the armies themselves. But it seems likely that the emperor approved of the process, which began to entrench his eastern armies into secure locations from which they could better defend the empire from Arab raids. At the website and on Facebook, you can see a map of the earliest formation of the themes. It's a not-so-great scan I did from Warren Treadgold's definitely great book. I couldn't find another version online. The easiest way to picture the themes is to imagine that we've cut Anatolia into four corners. And the easiest theme to remember is the Armeniakon theme, or in the anglicized version, the Armeniac theme. This was obviously made up of the army of Armenia and guarded the top right corner, which covered both the Armenian mountains and the lands to the west as they sink down into Cappadocia. To the south, occupying the bottom right-hand corner, was the Anatolikon theme. This area was facing the Taurus Mountains, where the main thrust of Arab assaults would come from, but also stretched west into the Isaurian Mountains. I don't think on either podcast the origins of the word Anatolia have come up, but it comes from the Greek word for east, Anatoli, which makes sense given the peninsula's location compared to mainland Greece. The Anatolikon theme was manned by the former Army of the East. To the west, guarding the bottom left corner, would be the Thrakision theme, so named because this was to be the new home of the former army of Thrace. They would stand guard over the theoretically wealthy cities of the coast, like Ephesus and Sardis. Needless to say, they were not returning to Thrace. The Balkans would continue to be ignored while the Arab threat was so dire. In the top left corner would be the Obsikion theme, who would guard Chalcedon, Nicomedia, and of course, Constantinople. These were the former praesental armies, the armies in the emperor's presence. Recently they had been referred to as the Obsequium, meaning retinue, hence the Obsikion theme. I know it will take a little time to get used to the names, but as you can see, this was a fairly straightforward transition from the existing imperial armies into new settled areas of operation. The fifth and final theme created was the Caravisiani, or as I will probably end up calling it, the Caribisian theme. It was formed of soldiers, sailors, and marines who would guard the Aegean islands, along with Rhodes, Crete, and Cyprus. This is where the remnants of the army of Illyricum may have ended up, and Caravisiani comes from the Greek word karavis, meaning ship. As I said, We're fairly confident that the themes began to take shape while Muawiyah's army was absent. There is evidence for the building of forts and the rebuilding of city walls from around this time. But as I also mentioned, there is plenty of disagreement about how revolutionary this process was. I follow the line laid out by historian Mark Witto, which is that the themes were at this stage simply the new geographical homes of the army. The soldiers were not given grants of land, but continued to be paid by the imperial treasury. If you remember, Heraclius had just about halved soldiers' pay during the wars with Persia, and it seems likely that this cut allowed the state to keep funding its armies. It's also probable that many federate soldiers had drifted away or been cut from the payrolls, and that the size of the armies began to shrink as other units were not replaced. While the military fanned out over Anatolia, Constans had plenty on his mind. The 31-year-old emperor was now a fully grown man, with a fully grown beard. He was popularly known as Constantinos Pogonatos, Constantine the Bearded, because of his luscious facial hair. You can see the amazing beard as depicted on his coins at thehistoryofbyzantium.com or on Facebook. The emperor had remained loyal to the bride presented to him when he was 11, Fausta, the daughter of Valentine, and they had had three sons, Constantine, Heraclius, and Tiberius. There is no consensus on how old the boys were. I've seen guesses that young Constantine IV was anywhere between 9 and 17 by 661. A compromise of 13 is suggested by Warren Treadgold, which I will go with. Having been given imperial power at age 11, Constans clearly saw no reason not to similarly empower his sons. So by 661, Constantine had been crowned as co-emperor and possibly already married to his bride Anastasia. His two younger brothers would follow him into the purple. Another reason for the hurry with this was that Constans was about to leave the capital. He was making plans to take the Obsikion army to Italy, at the very least to bring Africa and Italy fully back into the imperial fold after both exarchates had gone into rebellion earlier in his reign. Before he set sail, though, the emperor did two more things worth mentioning. Last episode I talked about how Constans had the Pope dragged before him and exiled for treason. Certainly this was a bold and autocratic move given the pontiff's lofty and usually revered status in the Roman world. And Constans was very firm on dissidence, and as he'd grown up, he refused to abandon his grandfather's monothelitism. The complaints of Chalcedonians had not died down, but the emperor stuck to the unpopular doctrine. In 661, two other men suffered his wrath. One was Maximus the Confessor, a highly respected theologian who was an outspoken critic of monothelitism. He also happened to be resident in Carthage and was blamed by the emperor for encouraging Gregory's rebellion. Maximus had his tongue and hand amputated. Meanwhile, Constans forced his own brother Theodosius into the priesthood, presumably to end any claims he might have on the throne, and then in 661 had him murdered. Our lack of sources leave us questioning the emperor's motives. He's about to leave Constantinople and spend years in the West, so the obvious conclusion would be that he didn't want his brother seizing control of the government while he was gone. We have no idea if Theodosius had actually made any seditious moves. The histories report that the emperor was hated by the people of Constantinople for these impious acts, but we have no way of knowing how unpopular he was, or whether that unpopularity had any bearing whatsoever on his decision to leave. So, in spring 662, Constans took a large contingent of the Obsikion army and sailed for Thessalonica. From there he marched overland to Athens and then Corinth. There he collected regiments of the Caribbean theme, and in 663 he sailed to Tarentum in Italy. The emperor had left his wife and children behind in Constantinople. Constantine IV was officially in charge of the capital, though doubtless his advisers had plenty to do. Once the army had disembarked at Tarentum, Constance began to drive off the local Lombard garrisons. It seems that the emperor hoped to push the Germans from the south of the country, thus giving himself a more secure Italian base from which to begin his work in the west. The small towns en route surrendered until the emperor reached Beneventum, the capital of the local Lombard duke. Beneventum is right in the middle of the Italian peninsula on the same horizontal line as Naples. The city put up strong resistance to the Byzantine siege, while messengers raced north to tell King Grimold. When news reached Constance that the main Lombard army was making its way south, he broke off the siege. The emperor headed to Naples and left the bulk of his army with a subordinate, who was then defeated by the Lombard king. The Byzantines retreated in good order, but Constance's plans for Italy had to be shelved. Nevertheless, the emperor marched north to Rome, where the new Pope Vitalian greeted him cordially. Well, you would, wouldn't you, after your predecessor was hauled off in chains. Constance was the first Roman emperor to set foot in the Eternal City since the fall of the West, and he visited all the great churches and was very polite to everyone he met. But in the meantime, his soldiers carted off any precious metal they could find, and even apparently stripped the bronze tiles from the roof of the Pantheon. After 12 days, the army left Rome and made their way south. From Rhegium, they set sail for Syracuse in Sicily, where Constance was to set up his home for the next 5 years. So what was he up to? Why had the emperor left Constantinople for Syracuse? The sources claim that he was planning to move the capital of the whole empire to Sicily. That, like his grandfather had threatened to, he was going to move west, away from the concerns of the east, to entrench the empire nearer to its Roman roots. Whether that was his long-term plan, we don't know. In the short term, Constance was clearly trying to more directly control the administration of the west to prevent its fall into Arab hands. With Egypt gone, his two best sources of grain were now Sicily and Africa. Clearly, the revolts of the previous decade had concerned him, and he felt his own presence was needed to stop the rot. By basing himself in Sicily, he could provide naval support to defend Africa, while also keeping his own field army paid and fed. The emperor began to levy taxes rigorously, not only in Sicily and southern Italy, but also in Sardinia and Africa. He also began to confiscate church plate to help pay for his army and administration. Back in the east, Muawiyah emerged victorious from the civil war and became the new caliph. This was bad news for Byzantium. Muawiyah made Damascus the new capital of the caliphate and renewed his assaults on Romania with vigor. By 662, the Armenians had returned to their former masters, and in 663 and 64, Arab armies probed into Anatolia, although the themes dealt with this adequately. By 665, though, events began to move quicker. Constance clashed with Gennadius, the exarch of Carthage, who then fled to Muawiyah when his own men overthrew him. Gennadius asked the caliph for an army to restore him to Africa, and Muawiyah duly obliged. Gennadius died en route, but the army kept coming. Constance sent men to reinforce the army of Africa under the command of Nicephorus, but he was defeated by the advancing Arabs. The Muslim force plundered the southern part of the exarchate and occupied parts of Tripolitania. This was a dangerous situation because it meant the Arabs had a permanent base on the African side of the Libyan desert. Meanwhile, in Anatolia, Muawiyah put tremendous pressure on the Armeniakon theme. Every summer between 665 and 668, the Syrian army would attack the borderlands and then spend the winter in Byzantine territory in an occupied town. After 3 years of utter frustration, the general of the theme, Saborius, snapped. With no support coming from Constantinople and the emperor away in Sicily, Saborius rebelled, declared himself emperor, and sent word to Muawiyah seeking his support. The caliph agreed in exchange for a hefty tribute once the new man was on the throne. I should point out that the theme generals were known as strategos, from the Greek word for general. Constance sent Nicephorus and some of his men back to Constantinople, and they led out an army to meet the rebel general. Unfortunately for the emperor, Saborius died when he fell from his horse en route. The Armeniacon army had supported him, but clearly many of them had just been following orders, as they immediately resubmitted themselves to the authority of the emperor. The revolt of Saborius reminds us of why the emperors had rarely left the capital in the last few centuries. And it was not only Constance's absence that was causing problems. His lack of military victories on any front was damaging to his legitimacy. And the defeats in Africa in particular seemed to discredit his decision to locate himself in the West. Chalcedonians everywhere were still angry about Monothelitism, and the Sicilians in particular were fed up with the imposition of heavier taxes than they were used to by their new guest. Even some of the Obsikion soldiers began to complain about having spent so long away from their homes near Constantinople. Which particular cocktail of disapproval turned out to be the right blend, we'll never know. But in the summer of 668, Constance was visiting the baths when one of his chamberlains smashed him over the head with a soap dish and killed him. He was 37 years old and had done a far better job of running the empire than might have been expected for 27 years. The count of the Obsikion army, Mizizius, was proclaimed emperor soon after, but it's not clear that he was the mastermind behind the plot. Many of his own men refused to recognize him, and the strategos of the Carabisians took his men and sailed home to avoid being associated with the coup. Loyal troops soon overthrew Mizizius, and Constantine IV was acclaimed emperor back in Constantinople. Whatever discontent there was with Constance, it clearly wasn't widespread enough to overthrow the Heraclian dynasty. I think the opinion of the histories is clouded by the fact that Constance was murdered in Sicily. It makes his 5-year stay there seem like he never intended to return to the capital. But at 37, he may well have thought time was on his side, that he could strengthen the West before returning home. However, if that was his plan, it largely failed. Sadly, almost every proactive military decision that Constance took was unsuccessful, but there may have been very little he could do about that. In terms of reactive, defensive decisions, he was far more successful. He held the door to Armenia open and helped keep Carthage out of Arab hands for now. And his creation of, or approval of, the plan for the themes would secure the empire's future. In a way, Constance continued his grandfather's work by using the Taurus Mountains as the empire's new first line of defense. Behind them, he deployed the empire's military strength to ensure that the Arabs would find the path to Constantinople as well guarded as possible. As for his trip westward, obviously it failed in that it cost him his life. But was there merit in the plan? He was definitely right to see danger in the loss of the West, even if none of the moves he made to defend it had much effect. Perhaps if he'd lived, he would have found a better solution, but it seems unlikely given the continuing advance of Arab armies. Byzantine commanders were still reluctant to lose all the men they had by making a last stand, and the self-confidence and skill of the Arab cavalry continued to carry the day. Initially, when I'd read that the emperor had left his wife and children behind and established a new capital, well, I thought perhaps Constance was making up for those lost teenage years, but the sources say nothing of the sort. Even though they accuse Constance of being cruel and inflexible, they also call him devout and loyal to his family. In fact, it's claimed that he tried to send for them to come and join him, but the court in Constantinople would not countenance it. And they were probably right, because with the imperial family gone, a coup would surely not have been far behind. Constance, therefore, passes from the stage as a decent emperor. I think there's something moving about him being handed the reins of government at 11 and giving his entire adult life to the service of Romania. With a bit of luck and a lot of hard work, he helped mould the Roman state into one that could survive an unprecedented series of military disasters. Next time, we'll see if his son Constantine IV can continue the family's work. Thank you so much for listening. I thought you might want to know that I've updated the bibliography at thehistoryofbyzantium.com. You can find the link in the top right-hand corner of the homepage. I've also changed my Twitter handle to @ByzantiumCast if you're looking for me there. I also want to say a big thank you to those who have recently bought episode 28 and those who've just sent donations. It really means a lot to me, and it's always slightly frustrating not to be able to thank you all individually. I hope this will do for now, and that me getting the episodes out as quick as I can is my silent thank you. Thanks to all of you, the History of Byzantium podcast now has strong walls guarding it from the enemies that threaten its survival. But what good are walls without defenders on them? It's no good relying on the Scholares anymore. Do you remember the Scholares? They were the old palace regiments that slowly over time became merely an honorific title that senators liked to collect for themselves and didn't expect to do any military service. Apparently, one of Justinian's more amusing ways of raising cash was to announce that a regiment of the Scholares were to be shipped out to Dara to fight the Persians. Well, you're imperial soldiers, aren't you? And then the terrified senators would be forced to pay bribes to get out of the service. No, they simply won't do any more. We need well-trained professional recruits. And you know what really keeps their morale up when they're up on the walls? iTunes reviews. Yes, your encouraging words and star ratings will keep them alert as they scan the horizon for danger.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.